I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. With 25 to 34-year-olds 30% more likely than other Americans to live in central cities, there's a big opportunity for cities to capture new people and new money. But what happens when these young adults begin to couple and have children? Will they remain in cities, or will they make the traditional trek to the suburbs to raise their kids? It's a question teams from the Institute of Design have been wrestling with, and they'll tell us what they learned today on Smart City. Also with us is Dr. Heather Weiss, who founded the Harvard Family Research Project to support the successful development of children from birth to adulthood. Our subject is kids in cities, today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Steve Babich and Clint Barth just earned Master of Design degrees from the Institute of Design in Chicago. Steve's area of focus is innovation strategy and planning, and his work includes a stint at Doblin, where he teamed with four U.S. cities on their innovation strategies. Clint is a designer who's worked with small startups, nonprofits, and Fortune 100 companies. He is currently a consultant for Gensler, one of the world's largest design, planning, and architecture firms. Describe the problem you were trying to tackle with kids in cities.
Well, the question was, how can cities attract and retain families with economic options? And what we mean by economic options is this project is not geared towards low-income families because cities have low-income families on their agenda. Families with economic options, meaning middle and upper-class families, middle, upper-middle, and upper-class families, one, provide a tax base for cities. Two, they spend money on the local economy. And three, they are very active in their communities. So that was basically the question we were trying to tackle.
I know you encountered some criticism, some misgivings about dealing with this market at all. The question has been raised, why aren't you dealing with families who don't have financial options? What about their future in cities? How did you respond?
I think it's just coming at another part of the problem. Obviously there's no shortage of problems in cities. So this is just looking at another area to explore, coming at it from a different point of view, to create new solutions with new outputs as well. You could possibly say that the poor need more attention, but there's no reason why you have to exclude the wealthier or people with economic options from any attention at all. So it's just looking at another segment that hasn't received as much attention as the others.
You both had an interesting approach to defining the target market. In other words, the families you thought were the best prospects for remaining in cities once they started having children. Steve, how did you define your prospective market?
Well, the framework that we developed came out of the interviews that we conducted with parents themselves. And the framework basically evolved into a 2x2 matrix where if you can visualize, in the upper left quadrant were urban loyalists, and these are basically diehard city lovers. In the lower left would be suburban loyalists, and those are people who are very comfortable with the suburbs and believe that's the best place to raise a family. And the upper right quadrant is what we call tentative urbanites, and these might be singles in the city who got married, who are now having children, and are being persuaded by things such as better schools, space, and safety, or the perceived better schools, safety, and space in suburbs. But they're kind of on the fence. And then lastly, in the lower right quadrant are discontent suburbanites. And these are people who believe the suburbs were going to provide them the quote-unquote American dream, but are finding that it is actually a counterproductive quality of life and could be persuaded perhaps to move back to the city or have a fondness for the city still. The two segments of the framework that we think cities should target and focus on are the tentative urbanites and discontent suburbanites, and we've collectively dubbed them as the swing vote because they are the ones that are kind of teetering on the fence. They might move to the suburbs as tentative urbanites, or they are considering moving back to the city as discontent suburbanites. So that was kind of our overall framework for how we segmented parents, so to speak.
And Clint?
It is pretty close. I think the main difference is that we concentrated less, or we didn't concentrate at all on attracting people from the suburbs to the city. We thought that was a real uphill battle. So we concentrated more on retaining the couples who are already in the city to more keep them from defecting, if you will, to the suburbs. We thought that'd be effective because, you know, there's a constant influx of new people into the city. You graduate college or, you know, you're in your young or your early 20s, you come to the city, and then generally you would leave in your late 20s as you raise a family. So we thought if we could stop that leaving, there's a, you know, that way we could go to increase market adoption. The idea of market adoption also leads us to the strategy we use of the bell curve, or the way we looked at it was there are innovators and there are the early adopters who are already in the city. We're trying to attract the early majority to increase the market share of young families that a city has.
Clint, you use Jeffrey Moore's concept of crossing the chasm to define the market and how you would have to treat that market. Explain that concept of crossing the chasm.
Jeffrey Moore's crossing the chasm is his take on market adoption for what he calls disruptive innovations, which is rather than just a continuous innovation is a small or incremental improvement to a product or service that makes it easier for someone to adopt. Disruptive is a new product or service where it's where in order for it to be adopted by people, they need to change their perspective or change their mindset or just kind of completely change the way they do things. We thought that was more relevant to the problem because these people who are moving to the suburbs, this idea of raising a family in the suburbs is entrenched in the American mind. So this is something that they were raised in the suburbs. They expect to go back and raise their children in the suburbs. So to change their perspective enough that they now feel the city is a viable option is basically a 180 in their perspective. So that, to us, makes it more of a disruptive innovation. Therefore, we follow some of the things outlined in Jeffrey Moore's book, where he says the biggest hurdle is getting from those early majority, the ones who have already accepted it, the early adopters have already accepted it, and getting the early majority to kind of adopt their mindset. That's the chasm, as he calls it, between those two different segments of people.
Clint talks about the idea of the suburbs being perceived as the right place to raise your children, and that idea having been embedded in the American mindset. Steve, you looked at 50 years of Better Homes and Gardens. What did you find there?
That was actually really a very interesting analysis, kind of an era analysis of Better Homes and Gardens, one of the main publications that, what we come to find out, really is driven urban sprawl. They were actually connected with the housing and development industry, and they really just basically promoted moving to less dense areas, increasing the size of your homes, putting up fences between your neighbors, putting articles relating to fear of, alluding to, so to speak, fear of other races, quite honestly. And there are a lot of interesting insights that came out of that 50-year analysis. And you could just see that visually through the publication from 1955 to 2006, the size of homes quadrupling, adding a second home, putting a room on top of your garage, and just furthering the notion that more space is necessary, and it's kind of counter to what cities can provide in terms of density, small scale communities, and the rich social interaction that you get from that. So it's a very interesting analysis.
What were the biggest problems you found with families with children remaining in cities?
What Steve was just talking about in the entrenched ideas, and even back to question one when he asked what the problem is, a big part of the problem is perception. And a lot of people just never even give the cities a chance. They, assume they have these preconceived notions about the city and about the suburbs, and they have social pressures to move to the suburbs, and it's really just a lot easier. It's kind of a plug-and-play type thing where, you know, you could do the work to make sacrifices, and you can face the challenges of living in the city. But for a lot of people, it's easier just to pack up and leave and go to the suburbs where you have one school to choose. You pick from one house that looks like most of the others. You know, it's really the elimination of choices that makes the suburbs an easier overall choice. So that, to me, is the problem, is that the poor perception of the city combined with an easy out in the suburbs is really two of the main parts of the problem. I mean, there are, you know, of course, like I said, cities aren't perfect. They are difficult, and there are many challenges that people have to face. But I think if you want to say the main challenge is just that the American way of life is to raise your children in the suburbs. And that's the main problem and the main hurdle that we're dealing with getting acceptance to the city. We can make ease of use improvements, and that was definitely a focus of our project. But those improvements, I think the effect they really have is letting people know, you know, it's not just those improvements, it's about communicating those improvements and communicating that, number one, we're attempting to make the city better for your children. But at the same time, as you're communicating benefits, it's kind of planting that seed that it is possible to raise your children in the city, and that the suburbs don't have to be the default choice for raising a family.
Clint, you say it's a problem of perception. What are the perceptions about raising children in cities? What are the perceptions of those problems?
Well, the big three are the safety, space, and education. Just generally the idea that city schools don't perform as well as schools in the suburbs. People don't have the same amount of private space in the city as they do in the suburbs. And just cities are generally less safe than the suburbs. And that's the prevailing mindset. But it could be argued. I mean, our research points to things like, particularly in the city of Chicago, the best Chicago public schools perform as well or better than the best suburban schools. Housing is generally smaller in the city, but it appreciates at a level much higher than suburban housing. And space or safety, you know, of course, the numbers are lower in the city, but you get into the average of the entire city, which incorporates quite a few different areas. So it's really apples to oranges comparing the two. When we focused in on an area like, again, to use Chicago, like Lincoln Park, and compare that to a suburb of about the same demographics, the numbers were virtually the same. So it's just the overall you hear about the crime in the cities and that type of thing. And the way of sheltering yourself from it is to kind of move to the suburbs. So it is safety, space, and education. I'm sure Steve will back me up. He heard the same thing over and over again.
Steve, what did you find as principal problems?
Well, we heard a lot of interesting stories from the parents that we talked to. Obviously, schools is probably the number one thing that just constantly came up. Safety, not quite as much, but it was more about space and schools. But then there were interesting stories we hear from parents, particularly in the city, of how diversity is basically king in the city, and it's much more difficult to find that in the suburbs. One parent told of a story in which her son drew a picture of his class, the members of his class, and it's basically half African American and half Asian American, and he's the only Spanish child in the class. So he draws the picture of his class, shows it to his mom. The mom immediately says, "Oh, there you are. That's a very nice picture." And he says, "How did you know who I was?" And it was just amazing to hear this story, and he recognizes he's no different from anybody else in the class, and it's just a part of life in the city. And it was just an amazing story that we heard from parents. And the parents in the city just spoke about close-knit communities, having social networks, and we heard from a few parents who talked about the separateness in the suburbs, of having to really struggle to find access to other children, the lack of density kind of contributes to that. Everybody's got their scheduled activities, so they're in their cars straight from their homes off to their scheduled activities. And you don't have that kind of natural interaction that often occurs in the city. And then very quickly, that's not to say all suburbs are like that, but there are certainly sprawl-oriented suburbs that do have these problems, and families are finding that the American dream is not necessarily there.
Can those problems be corrected?
Yeah, it was interesting. One of the things that came out of the research was the idea of redefining those terms. We found that the parents who are committed to staying in the city and raising their children here don't necessarily define those terms in the same way as parents who move to the suburbs might. For example, the idea of education, parents in the suburbs always point to test scores being higher and use that as a indicator of how successful their children might be in later life. But the parents who are committed to the city, they define it a little differently. When they kind of realize that a third, let's say a third of their children's learning takes place in the classroom, and maybe two thirds take place outside the classroom in the various museums or theaters, libraries, any of the cultural outlets the cities have, as well as just walking down the street, going down to Chinatown or Little Italy or, you know, engaging in any one of the street fairs. They realize the value of the environment aiding their children to become more well-rounded, to become more, you know, just aware of their surroundings and just to be exposed to these unique experiences that the suburbs don't provide, that to the parents who are committed to the city, that makes that more than makes up for a perceived lack in test scores or actual lack, differentiation in scores.
How can the city's assets be used to address the concerns of safety and space?
The idea of safety was, again, back to awareness. A lot of the, we heard over and over again that the parents felt their children were more aware just by being exposed to a wider variety of things. They also felt that because of the close proximity of neighbors, that the community, there was more of a sense of community. They visited the same stores, saw the same shopkeepers, saw the same neighbors at the same times on the of the day. Parks, another place where you would meet up with other parents. So they had a stronger network because you see the same people because they're all closer together. So if needed, one could keep an eye, a neighbor could keep an eye on your children, or even strangers, just having eyes on the street, just having more people, the idea of safety in numbers. That was how their general idea of how you define safety in the city is safety in numbers. And then space, where in the suburbs, space is defined by ownership and what you own and the size of the plot of land or the size of your house. That's space in the suburbs. In the city, it's more of a shared space. There are so many more public buildings, public spaces. City parents leverage those to be an extension of the house. So if the house is smaller and there isn't room to have a playroom for your kids, well, you've got a park right down the street that they can go play. You've got, on a rainy day, you've got a museum that's having an exhibit, they have those public areas that you leverage to kind of create a third space almost, or a space outside of your home for your children to use.
Steve, you also found that space was an issue for parents, as well as education is another issue. How did you find that the city could use its assets to address these problems that parents perceive?
Actually, one of the things we found was that the point of view was that, well, let's think about what a city actually has. What are the actual signature strengths of a particular city? And these are strengths a city has that are unique to one particular city versus others. So, for example, Chicago has a signature strength in architecture. So how might you leverage that asset, be it architecture firms, the architects as the people themselves, the various buildings that have built in Chicago? How do you create learning experiences for children and integrate that signature strength into their learning so they have these very rich real-world experiences to draw from? So that's one area we investigated and developed concepts around. In terms of space and social interaction, it's just that small-scale density, the density of cities, their small-scale neighborhoods, and these local communal parks, this kind of middle space between private being your home and large public spaces such as Millennium Park. The middle space called communal spaces is a very interesting place for rich social interaction to occur. And those might be storefronts, coffee shops, cafes, but they are very rich social interactions take place in those spaces. And for example, one parent whose husband had recently deceased, right when we were interviewing her, talked about her recent life celebration of her husband, or her celebration of her husband's life. And she had this at her home, but rather than calling people and emailing them to tell them about this celebration, she used posters and flyers in coffee shops, in parks, on lampposts and so forth. And people would call her standing in front of the poster at the coffee shop saying, "I'm stopping by. You can count on me being there." And she had about 150 to 200 people show up at her home. Most of the people she knew, and some she actually did not know directly, maybe if they were from her husband's work. But it was just an amazing outpouring of support for her that basically they found out through the public spaces in the local neighborhood. And that, to me, was probably the most powerful story that we heard. So when you think about space and social interaction and developing networks and communities, that was just an extremely powerful story to draw from.
What is it about the Institute of Design's approach to a problem like Kids in Cities that makes it different from, say, standard marketing research?
The quick answer is the user-centered approach. You know, I mean, we look at, we repeated that school safety and space are the main problems, and you'll find that in, you know, any number of reports out there saying the same thing. But the way we go about solving these problems is a little bit different. You know, rather than saying we need to have better performing schools, we need to lower student-teacher ratio, we need to test more to raise those scores and educate the students in these certain areas, it's more, how can we increase the overall learning of the students? Where are, you know, take a broader look at the word education and find it outside of schools and just try to come at it with a new perspective. That was really what we just tried to do, was try to present a little something new and stay away from the conventions of more parks, more police, and more schools, and try to offer something a little different approach to it. You know, not just a policy-based or not just a, you know, more not throw money at the problem or not just increase numbers of, again, parks, place, or playgrounds or schools, but to try to study the people who are going through this, mostly the parents. I mean, you know, when we're talking about attracting kids to the cities, we're really talking about attracting parents. So look at the parents and find out where the problems they're having are, you know, what they're trying to accomplish, why they're having a hard time accomplishing that, and look at those barriers there and try to find ways to solve them, which were mostly ideas around the idea of supporting them. How can we support the parents who want to live here?
I think if rather than looking at it from the institutional's perspective, where you're constrained by all of the bureaucracy and various barriers, but looking at it from the user's point of view really gives you the kind of insight and stories that Clint had alluded to in terms of, you know, what are the things that parents are doing right now to make living in the city workable? You know, how do we draw from that? What analogies exist today? And when you start to hear about those kinds of stories, the things that parents are doing now, that gives you a sense for, well, here's how we might step that up a level and really make it a powerful solution for cities. And that's just a much different way. I mean, it's amazing. It's a radically different way from the way people come at problems traditionally. They are very constrained by the systems within which they operate. And taking it from this user point of view is a much more powerful way, is often a much more powerful way to address the problem.
Steve Babich and Clint Barth are designers from the Institute of Design in Chicago. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
It has been widely reported recently that home prices across the country are up. The high cost of home ownership has made once prospective home buyers into renters. Affordably priced prefabricated homes are experiencing an upsurge in popularity, mainly among the younger, highly educated, and upwardly affluent population. The San Jose Mercury News reports that prefab home builders are bringing in a lot of business due to the low cost of their homes, which can be less than half as expensive as building a standard house. The cheap housing is also appealing to environmentalists, who can more easily and more affordably convert their homes to be energy efficient. And environmental friendliness is now on the agenda of many cities across the globe. That includes Menlo Park, California, a city in the San Francisco Bay Area that has joined with nearly 500 American cities in volunteering to take local action to counter the effects of global warming. And while the EcoCity has made this environmentally friendly commitment, environmentalists are saying that the city's physical plans for its future growth work against those green goals. The Menlo Park Almanac reports that city officials are opposed to any plans to increase the city's density, not near the city's retail developments, downtown, or commuter rail line. Critics say this adamant stance will encourage sprawling development that many say contributes to the global warming problems the city has pledged to fight against. And one of the most notorious causes of global warming has shown its first downturn since 1981. The amount of miles Americans are driving has stopped rising for the first time in 26 years. USA Today reports that federal highway data has revealed a steadying growth rate in vehicle miles traveled, despite an estimated 1 million more drivers on the road since last year. Many attribute the changing trend to improvements in public transit, shifting demographics, and most predominantly, rising gas prices. However, a USA Today poll reveals that rising prices may not play as great a role in changing driver habits as the steadying vehicle miles traveled rate would suggest. 64% of people surveyed said that no matter how high gas prices rose, they would not make public transit their main mode of transportation. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk to Dr. Heather Weiss, founder and director of the Harvard Family Research Project. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Where have you visited lately? Keith Bellows, editor of National Geographic Traveler, is here to give us the latest on city destinations around the globe. Keith, in the current issue of National Geographic Traveler, your City Life column features Seville, Spain. What intrigues you about that city?
Well, I think first of all, very few people really know of it. I mean, we talk a lot about Madrid and we talk a lot about Barcelona. But Seville's sort of one of those little secrets. It's about 350 miles southwest of Madrid, but it's really off the beaten track.
And what did you find there?
Well, this is sort of the heartbeat of Spain when you think about things like flamenco and tapas. And I had never been to Seville until about a year and a half ago. I'm a sort of a big favorite of I love Barcelona, but there's this new place that's opening up really soon. It's a Metropole Parasol, which is a covered market. It's got these incredible panoramic terraces. You're seeing sort of this was a sort of an old city, and now some of the neighborhoods are being reclaimed. I mean, it used to be a lot of Muslims and Jewish and Christians were in sort of really gave this a lot of a lot of cultural, it's a real cultural mélange, and that's really reflected now. It's a really walkable city. You can see flamenco dancing, all over the place. In fact, they even have a flamenco dance museum, and there's great flamenco social clubs all over the city.
How much time do you have to spend to make the trip worthwhile?
Well, we did this in City Life under our rubric of 48 hours, and it is one of those cities that's very walkable. You can go and find there's an area called Triana where there's ceramic workshops, and this is really wonderfully colored plates and tiles, and all of this is within a couple of an hour's walk. I mean, it's a very approachable, very easy to navigate city.
Closer to home, you urge readers to return to New Orleans. What will they find there now?
Well, the interesting thing, and the writer of this piece, Andrew Nelson, who's a contributing editor, has been bugging us now for about a year and saying, we really got to get past Hurricane Katrina and see the city for what it is. And it truly is back. I mean, first of all, some of the most historic neighbors we're on high ground. I mean, you're talking about the Faubourg area, the Garden District, the French Quarter. So they really didn't get a lot of damage in those areas. So what we've done is we've constructed a little walking tour for you that starts at the Café du Monde. So in the morning, you can get your beignet and coffee, and then you can go through Jackson Square, which, of course, is where President Andrew Jackson's statue is, and then really wander through St. Louis Cathedral. There's a great bookstore, Faulkner House Books. It's a very small independent bookstore. Antique stores like the Regency House, which is on Royal Street. And if you want po' boys, and I always have to get them when I go to New Orleans, it's Johnny's Po' Boy. I mean, it's the indulgence you can't resist, as well as places like Napoleon House, the bar and cafe there. There's Jazz Park, which has free afternoon concerts. So, it really isn't the sort of ravaged city that we remember from post Hurricane Katrina.
Do you know if all the shopping in downtown has now reopened?
A lot of it has. And I mean, the thing is that as what usually happens in a situation when disaster strikes, out of the rubble, new things, you know, really emerge. I mean, you've got places like Lucullus or Lucullus, depending on how you pronounce it, on Chart Street. This is one of those classic places, old silver, 18th century crystal, champagne flutes. Really a classic sort of shopping spot in New Orleans. It's back. And then you have, places like Fifi Mahoney, which is this wonderful little place where, you know, you stock up before you party. So it's the wigs, it's the sort of the wild suits, the really kind of extravagant, outrageous costumery that you sort of expect when you go to New Orleans.
You also wrote in this issue about bed and breakfast finds in New York, and I never think about that as an option when I travel to New York.
You know, you really don't. And I go to New York a lot, and I've sort of gotten used to I used to have an apartment there, and I finally got used to the fact that I just have to live with the $400 or $500 a night hotels. And first of all, you're seeing a lot of small boutique hotels emerge, especially in areas that, you know, where there were no hotels, like the Lower East Side and so forth. But now what's happening is you are beginning to see, and not just a few, a lot. I mean, we had in this issue six bed and breakfasts. All of them are very small. They're very intimate. They're very quirky. They've got their, sort of their own individual charm. There's 83 Horatio Street, which is right on the sort of edge of Greenwich Village. It's very bohemian. It's got, you go in, there's a little parlor and a lounge, and then, curved staircase, and, there's wonderful sort of inlaid woodwork and fireplaces and hardwood floors. And you especially wouldn't expect to see it at, starting at $190. And then you can go all the way down to the other end of town, which is to Sugar Hill Harlem Inn, which is, not too far from Columbia. It's in Harlem. It's near the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. It's a 1906 brownstone. And it's like going back into sort of the history of Harlem. It's really got that kind of old world charm. And that starts at $125. So, I mean, these are incredibly reasonable prices for New York.
Keith Bellows is editor for National Geographic Traveler. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Heather Weiss is the founder and director of Harvard Family Research Project. Its mission is to help create more effective practices, interventions, and policies to support children's successful development from birth to adulthood. She's also senior research associate and lecturer at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Heather, what do we now know as fact about child development?
I think we now know as fact that kids need an array of supports in order to promote their learning so that they can enter school ready to succeed in school and they can exit school ready to succeed in a job, as a citizen in a community, in higher education, all the kinds of ways I think we want kids to succeed as adults. There is a strong developmental science research base that supports the need for family involvement in kids' learning and development, beginning probably prior to birth with all of the prenatal care that moms get, and certainly continuing on up through the time that kids launch to go off, from high school to college or some kind of post-secondary training. And as the mother of a 23-year-old, I think that family involvement probably continues on up through adult life. But I think what's new is an understanding of what we call the non-school or complementary learning supports that kids need in addition to a strong school. So when I think about what's different in my professional lifetime as a result of the research that many people have been doing, it is that we have a firmer understanding than ever before that it isn't just schools that we need to count on to support kids' learning and development. Families are critical to that, and I'll come back to that in a minute. In addition, a whole array of community-based supports, and this includes out-of-school time programs, summer learning opportunities, youth development opportunities, are all critically important if we're going to get kids through to adulthood as the kind of adults that I think the kids and all the rest of us want them to be. I mentioned the family piece. In early April, the journal Child Development, which is one of our premier journals sort of reporting what we know about what kids need from a research perspective, did an article on the ongoing longitudinal results of the National Child Care Study. And this particular article reported on the data at sixth grade. It's a longitudinal study, and it contrasts kids that were part of child care in early childhood with kids that were at home rather than in child care. And the sixth grade results show that kids who are in child care are a little more aggressive in school and that they have larger vocabularies than kids that didn't go to preschool or child care. What the article also says is that at the sixth grade point in time, as well as in earlier points in time, by far the strongest predictor of how kids are doing academically and in terms of their social competence is parenting. So that parent piece is critical, as are the other supports that are also supports for parents. A parent who has a child in a good out-of-school time program sees that as a support for him or her to work, while at the same time the child is safe and getting an enrichment experience. So I think what we've learned is that if we're really intent on promoting competent kids, intellectually, socially, civilly competent kids, we've got to marry and link together the kind of supports that I've just described. And I see increasingly recognition of that. At the Harvard Family Research Project, where I am, we're making the argument for the set of supports I've described, which we call complementary learning. Other people label it differently. I don't think the label matters so much as the concept. And we're now looking at cities around the country where mayors and superintendents of public schools and community groups are starting to try to build what we call complementary learning systems. So we're seeing an idea that comes from, I think, people's lived experience as well as from the research now begin to take root in a variety of innovations in cities around the country. It's a very exciting time to be doing this work as a result.
I want to come back and talk about complementary learning systems, but first I want to visit this notion of a strong family. And obviously we have many families that are not strong in America. There are many families that are disadvantaged in many ways and cannot hold up their end of the strong family bargain, if you will. And, you know, that's not an area that we're terribly comfortable with when it comes to public policy, public interventions. What's available to us? What are the resources, the programs, the interventions that we have at our disposal to make families stronger?
Start from the assumption that many more families are strong than we typically think. And from the point of view of supporting kids' learning and development, it may be a single mom who's holding two jobs, who takes 15 minutes to read with her child and talk with the child about a book. It may be that same mom who negotiates with her employer to be able to take time off to go to the child's parent-teacher conference. What we find is a lot of families that people sometimes label as not strong, in fact, have strengths. So the starting place for us is to start understanding and drawing on those strengths. When you do that, you can then build trust with families and link them to a range of family support programs that provide them help with this. And we're now looking at cities around the country where mayors and superintendents of public schools and community groups are starting to try to build what we call complementary learning systems. So we're seeing an idea that comes from, I think, people's lived experience as well as from the research now begin to take root in a variety of innovations in cities around the country. It's a very exciting time to be doing this work as a result.
Well, and that makes sense. Two responses, Heather. One is, as a single mother myself, I can remember just feeling, and as a very young mother, feeling very lost and overwhelmed by job and school and parenting all at the same time. If you had said services to me, that would have gone right over my head. I mean, I never would have related that, number one, thinking I didn't have time, and two, it's like, services, what services? I mean, that language even would not have related to me as a young mother. So that's sort of one response, and I'm interested in how you deal with that. And second, I appreciate what you're saying, that you make the assumption that there are hidden strengths or unrecognized strengths in many families, many mothers who are going it alone. And yet, you know, and I know, there are a lot of mothers or families who are just so bereft of resources. They're just, you know, spending 15 minutes reading when you can't read, or when you've got a house full of kids, or, you know, just chaos around you is expecting a lot. So again, I'm curious how you sort of deal with both of those real world situations.
I think in the first instance, the kind of feeling lost and overwhelmed and I don't need services, you know, I don't have time for services. I think one of the critical entry points is the school, and the school reaching out to families to make sure that they're coming in for the parent-teacher conference, understand how the child is doing in school. And our research shows, in fact, that schools that do that, that go the extra mile to try to engage families, but, you know, a teacher will make a call home and talk about how your child has done well on something as opposed to, you know, a problem. Often schools reach out with problems, but schools that, for example, reach out with positive news, engage the mom or the dad or both in a conversation about how the child is doing, what's happening in school, some things they might be able to do at home, you know, to support what the school is trying to do. Those kinds of outreach efforts pay off in terms of engaging more families. And then there's data that shows when those families engage, in fact, their kids do better. So I guess I would use as an entry point for everybody a school reaching out in the ways I've described meaningfully to talk about how the child is doing. You have a common interest in that child and how the child is doing. And if you can open up that communication, oftentimes there will be things that a mom or a dad can do, small things like just checking to make sure the homework is done or those kinds mm-hmm. of things. So I think that's a very important entry point that addresses kind of the lost and overwhelmed sense in a very pragmatic way.
Now, let me stop you right there, because that makes plenty of sense to me, but that's not until age, what, 5 or 6. So we know from research that early childhood development is absolutely critical. And in a lot of ways, there's no, you know, there's certainly no broad-scale public response to what we now know is that critical period of development. I mean, some say that if children are not properly developing by age 2, age 3, that they are so far behind in life going forward. So, again, school as an entry point makes sense once you get to be 5 or 6 and you enter school. What about periods before that?
A number of states around the country now have created home visitation programs that begin at birth and continue anywhere from birth through age 2 to age 5. So Missouri, for example, has the Parents as Teachers program, and it's a voluntary home visit program open to any family in Missouri. A home visitor will come usually once a month and talk about parenting and the kinds of things you can do as a parent that support your child's development. For families that may need, you know, additional service assistance, they'll help you link to services. But they're very much centered on that early development and the parent as the child's first teacher. A number of states now have the Parents as Teachers program or the nurse family partnership, which is another model that comes out of the public health system. And what we're watching, I think, in a public policy terms, is a recognition of the importance of that kind of home visitation service, often linked to child care, so that the child is getting both a strong center-based experience and then the support at home through the home visitation program. Then I think every state in the United States has either a full-blown or a growing home visit program. And Kit Bond and Senator Bond and Senator Clinton have co-sponsored legislation called the Learning Begins at Home Act to try to create a federal funding stream to support home visitation that would address exactly the issue that you're describing.
Before we talk about complementary learning systems, again, that's an important subject. I want to get to it, but I want to come back to the research you referred to on daycare, on child care, and the longitudinal study with looking at sixth graders who had participated in daycare, or been in daycare, and those who had not. And you said, I think, one, they had a larger vocabulary. That's clearly a good thing, those who had been in child care. And you said they're more aggressive when it comes to school. That could be good or bad. Is that how do you interpret that?
I'm not sure how to interpret it. And I looked at their measures, and in some ways being a little more aggressive, as you said, can be good, and in some ways it can be disruptive to the classroom, which then means the teacher is spending time on maintaining the class as opposed to, you know, the instructional practice that she's trying to do. So my sense is it's a mixed blessing, but not, you know, all bad. And certainly the vocabulary piece is, you know, is important, you know, as well.
Well, where do you come out, Heather? Just it seems like every 5 years or so, there's a new spate of studies or headlines that suggest that working mothers are doing a terrible disservice to their children by putting them in daycare, and their children will suffer forever more. Where do you come out on this, looking at all the research?
If the only difference we can find at sixth grade in this longitudinal study is on the two things that we've talked about, on balance, child care is not doing any harm, and in fact, it may be creating some real advantages for kids. So I think we've had, you know, 25 or 30 years of conversation of the sort you just described. And from my point of view, the data now says that kids who are in child care are not in jeopardy. And in fact, there are a number of ways in which they benefit from that.
Heather, why do we force parents to cobble this stuff together? I mean, why do we have school systems? Why don't we have child development and education systems that then, you know, that then collect tax dollars and provide for the widest array of services? And, you know, certainly there can be competition within that. There can be choices within that. Even when there are choices available, even when there are options available, parents still have a hard time getting to the information. So, I mean, you were talking about states and cities that have taken a progressive approach to this complementary learning. Has anyone pushed it to the, what I would say is where we maybe should be, or at least consider being, and that is, again, breaking up education and rethinking it as child development and education and, you know, birth to adulthood in every form, weekend, summer, after school, so that it's all one system.
You could not be more right on. And I think America is ready for that conversation. And there are a number of us that are trying to provoke it, if you will. And I think with No Child Left Behind, you're going to see an increasing emphasis on what some people call extended learning opportunities, which in many ways is an effort to do exactly what you describe, break it up and put it back together in a way that research and I think common sense suggests are more appropriate to support the development of children.
Dr. Heather Weiss is the founder and director of Harvard Family Research Project. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Think your travel has an impact on the environment? CityView's commentator Walker Smith says there are consequences to the choices we make.
I am a road warrior. For over 20 years, my work has put me on a plane at least 2 days a week, and some weeks every day. My travel schedule has racked up millions of miles and millions of hours away from home. The person affected most by this is my wife, Joy, who has, without complaint, put up with it. I'm not proud of the many days and nights she has had to spend alone, but I enjoy what I do, and it more than pays the bills, so I keep at it. Whenever I can, though, I try to do something for her to even out the score. We probably dine out more than most couples because that's one thing I can do for her. I buy her small things I see in the airport that I think she might like, and if I'm off to someplace warm or exotic, I try to extend it over a weekend so that she can come too. All of this in an attempt to offset the impact of my work style. For the longest time, this struck me as a fair trade. I could travel without regret because I made up for it in other ways. Lately, though, I've come to question whether it's really that simple. Giving Joy something gives me permission to keep indulging myself without sacrifice. For two decades, I have made a practice of buying my way out of having to be less self-centered and less obsessed with work. The problem is that while I'm offsetting the bad things I'm doing, I'm still doing the same bad things. While I can offset the impact of what I do, the need to even the score in the first place is the bigger, underlying problem that I have yet to address. Lately, I've come to think that we all face this dilemma nowadays, particularly when it comes to global warming. One of the trendy answers to global warming is that of carbon offsets. What this means, in short, is that you can live a carbon-neutral lifestyle and thus not add to further warming by offsetting the carbon dioxide emissions generated to support your lifestyle by doing things that reduce carbon dioxide levels like planting trees. In other words, as long as you offset the negative consequences of how you live, you can keep living that way. Carbon offsets even the score, and I wholeheartedly endorse them. Yet we need more, because carbon offsets are just a way of coping, not a way of fixing the bigger underlying problem. Our wasteful lifestyles are the reason we need carbon offsets to begin with. We should not use them as a way of dodging more discipline and prudence. Excess and even greed do not go away just because we offset their environmental impact. It is tempting to use something like carbon offsets to duck the bigger problem. But what we really need, me especially, is less time on the road. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rutt is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.